Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the LSE for this LSE Festival event, where we're going to be discussing geoeconomics and the green transition. Welcome also to our audience online. The theme of the LSE Festival this year is how to save the planet. There are events on all week, including on Saturday, exploring what we can do to save the Earth, its people and environment from existential threats. These include from the climate crisis, conflict and risks associated with AI. At the end of each day, which today means after this event, there are complimentary reception and drinks here in the Marshall Building, so please do join. My name is Anna Valero. I'm professor in practice here at the LSE, at the Centre for Economic Performance and the Global School of Sustainability. I'm also director of the CP's Growth Programme, and I'm really happy to welcome our excellent speakers today. We have Ed Conway, we have Catherine Thomas, we have Linda Yu and Peter Hill. So I'm going to just briefly introduce the speakers in the order that we'll be hearing from them, which slightly confusingly is not the order they're sitting in. So Ed Conway, Ed is the economics and data editor of Sky News and a regular columnist for The Times and Sunday Times. Last month, he was named Business and Finance Journalist of the Year in the Press Awards for, among other achievements, his skill at helping viewers understand complex trade policy decisions and debate. His book, written in 2024, called The Material World, tells the story of the modern world through the lens of six foundational raw materials. I've just finished reading it and really recommend it. It was nominated as one of the Financial Times Books of the Year, and his next book, Trade World, will explore the history and future of globalization, and that's due to be published in September 2026. And I also understand you've just launched a new podcast as well. Very exciting. Peter Hill is visiting professor in practice here at the LSE and founding partner of North Star Advisory. As the CEO of COP26 in Glasgow, he led the UK's largest ever sustainability conference, just as we're emerging from the COVID pandemic in 2021. He's had a 25-year career in the civil service, holding some of the most senior roles in government, including as principal private secretary to the Prime Minister, Theresa May. And as many of you will know, it was during that era that the UK was the first major economy to sign net zero into law. Catherine Thomas is a professor of managerial economics and strategy here at LSE. She's also director of the CEP's trade program. Her research focuses on multinational companies, supply chains, and how the decisions that firms make affect their growth. Finally, Linda is an economist, writer, and broadcaster. She's fellow in economics at St. Edmund Hall, Oxford University, adjunct professor of economics at London Business School, and associate fellow at Chatham House. While a visiting professor at LSE Ideas, she chaired the LSE Economic Diplomacy Commission, which looked into how foreign economic policy should be set for a 21st century global economy. So very relevant to our discussion today. She's also author of several books, including The Great Economist and The Great Crashes, which has the subheading Lessons from Global Meltdowns and How to Prevent Them. So I think you can see that we have an excellent panel, highly qualified to talk about what we're going to be discussing today. So how action to tackle climate change and achieve net zero has been or might be affected by the current disruptions to energy markets, supply chains, and a renewed focus on economic security. So in terms of the format, we're going to have a short opening statement from each speaker. Then we'll have some time for discussion and Q&A from the audience, both in person and online. Please put your phones on silent so as not to disrupt the event. The event is being recorded and hopefully will be made available as a podcast, subject to there being no technical difficulties. So for social media users, the hashtag for today's event is hashtag LSE Festival. So that's enough from me. Ed, would you like to start?
So much. And it is it's an honour to be the journalist on the platform here and not part of the academy. But as a result, I may blather on a bit, Anna, so you could just tell me to cut it short if I do go on. I think, you know, this is talking as a journalist. We're living in such an extraordinarily interesting, in, you know, inverted commas in italic, time right now. I've always kind of been quite interested in the idea in economics of these different cycles, whether it's economic cycles or Kondratiev waves, civilizational cycles. And it feels like, you know, we have the kind of a cycles of globalization as well. When you think about the kind of the Roman Empire, or you think about the period of kind of intense globalization that we had in the run-up to the First World War, and then you have kind of these retractions from it. And it strikes me that we are in a moment now where we're in another kind of swing, where we're thinking once again about where things come from. And for those kind of periods in globalization where, you know, everyone is can be relatively sure that if you order something, it will actually turn up. You're ordering it from the other side of the world, you can be pretty assured that it will actually turn up. We're now, it feels, in a period where that is under question. It's under question for all sorts of reasons. It's under question for, you know, the obvious reason that is in headlines at the moment, for military action. It's under question because of, you know, in the last kind of 5 years, we've experienced a pandemic, which has raised enormous questions about supply chains. And it's under question as well, you know, back to the theme of what we're talking about here, because the nature of the green transition is that this is a very physical process where we need physical materials. And right now, there is a bit of a race to get hold of those materials and to secure the supply chains and develop the various industries that we need if we're going to actually achieve all of these goals that we've set out. And so when you think about the energy transition, and this is again, I guess this is not kind of necessarily an economic lens to think about it through, but to me, it is a very physical process. It's a physical process of getting hold of physical materials to create the infrastructure we need to have a cleaner environment. We need concrete for the foundations of wind turbines. We need copper that's going to go into the electricity network that we're going to create. We need lithium that's going into the batteries that are going to power all of those electric cars. So physical things still matter. And that's, you know, something I was trying to drum in my book a couple of years ago or a few years ago, Material World, which is we think, or we have thought up until recently, that we were dematerializing, but actually we weren't dematerializing. The physical economy is as important as it ever is. If you need data centers, if you need the internet, if you want AI, you need a physical infrastructure of data centers beneath it. And for that, you need the energy, you need the kind of physical infrastructure that goes into them. So physical things still matter, and it matters enormously for the energy transition as well. And now it feels we're in an era where that stuff comes from is actually kind of front and center all over again. I think that a world that is more resource intensive is also a world, and when I say resource intensive, I mean kind of the physical resources that are going into all of that physical infrastructure. Is a world where we once again are thinking about where this stuff comes from. And I think that's the point, is we are at a juncture now where all of a sudden geography, which seemed to be irrelevant for a long time, is relevant again. And I think that's a particular challenge for a country like the UK, which has essentially kind of deindustrialized and allowed a lot of the kind of physical industries that we used to have to be replaced by imports. And therefore, we are much more kind of focused on trade. And in that kind of previous world of globalization, where price was the main priority and where stuff came from was more or less irrelevant, that was fine. We're in a different world now. And so I think that's, you know, kind of where I started. That makes this a kind of interesting moment. I think it's particularly challenging for the UK because we have always been kind of at the vanguard of globalization and be a free open trading nation. But it's challenging because all of a sudden price is not the only consideration. Geography is a consideration now. And there is no other kind of sector or no other effort where this is, I mean, maybe AI, but where this is kind of quite so important to productivity and to the future of the planet. As the energy transition.
Thanks very much, Ed. In your book, there are so many very detailed examples of what those patterns look like as well. So over to you, Peter, for your views.
Thanks. So I'm going to talk about the sort of the geopolitics and then get down to some boring issues of intermediate products in supply chains. I think the story of climate over the last 10 or 15 years, and story and reality are not necessarily the same, has been that it's primarily an area of cooperation and collaboration internationally. Why? Because this is a common threat and we all have an interest in dealing with it. And I'm not so sure that's quite as true anymore. I think questions of power and interstate relations are now central to the question of climate change and the transition. And now, if you believe the sort of IMF, International Energy Agency view of the world, interstate competition means a slower transition, because it means less diffusion of technology, more trade barriers. It means the domestication of products in a way that is not maximizing economic efficiency. So the problem, if you want to save the planet and deal with climate change, is what do you do about the fact that geopolitics, left to its own devices, will mean slower transition, but you can't ignore it because it is now central to many aspects, just as it was under Biden. You had a US-China competition to see who could go faster, and now you have the US and China making very fundamentally different bets on the future of the energy system. One of them will be right and one of them will be wrong, in my view. Spoiler alert, it's not the United States, I think, who's going to be right. So what do you do about it? So the work that I've been doing with former colleagues and others is to say, you governments, particularly European governments, are saying a number of things at the same time. You're saying you want to decarbonize your economies, you want to onshore production, you want to increase growth and value added, you want to de-risk from China because you feel that that's a single source supplier is a vulnerability, and you want to do that without imposing enormous costs on businesses or the public balance sheet. Those are perfectly legitimate public policy objectives, and they self-evidently cannot all be true equally at the same time in every area. So you have to make choices. So we are trying to present policymakers with a framework for making choices. Where can you credibly compete in the new green tech economy? Where do you need to rely on partnerships with third countries who are not China? And what is it going to take to de-risk those supply chains in a way that is sustainable and credible across the things that really matter, rather than the 15 or 20 key clean techs? What are the things that actually matter, you really care about, and where should you intervene in the supply chain? So the work we've done, which I hope will be published imminently, tries to identify those nodal points. So how can you, and then come up with actual solutions. So how do you come up with a non-China battery supply chain that you can afford to sustain over the course of 10 or 20 years? Who are the partners who can help you build the permanent magnets without which your cars and your wind turbines and some of your defense kit won't function? How do you sustain a steel industry when you're never going to be cost competitive in Europe in the production of green iron, and so on and so forth? So what we're trying to do is to answer the sort of so what the sort of so what question. It's all very well to be worried about geoeconomics and the geopolitics of the transition, but that's of no use to anybody. What do you actually do about it? Where do you focus your attention? Where do you compete? Where do you import? And in some areas, where do you carry on depending on a single source supplier because there is no alternative? So that's the public good that we are seeking to create. And if you can wait another week or two, there should be a paper and some research coming out imminently. Thanks.
Thank you, Peter. I'm personally very much looking forward to seeing that report. So over to you, Catherine.
Okay, well, thank you very much. It is always really interesting to hear about the work that Ed and Peter are doing on the technologies that offer us a route out of carbon-intensive production. And they offer us a route out of carbon-intensive production processes because they are not emitters of CO2. So the green technologies that we need in order to achieve a green transition. And in a lot of their work, they've highlighted problems in the markets for these alternatives, coming from scarcity, coming from market concentration, coming from the geopolitics of these markets, and frictions that exist that limit their ability and their availability as substitutes, and therefore slow down the transition. So these are technologies that we need at various stages along our value chains in order to move us along out of emissions that are climate effect, producing negative climate externalities. So what industries are these? Well, we all know what the industries are. They're fossil fuel-based energy production. They're industries that intensively use fossil fuels and energy in production now, such as steel and other metals, chemicals, cement, agriculture, etc. And when we're thinking about how do we move out of carbon-intensive production, we've got to have a laser focus on the quantities of these externalities, negative externalities that are produced, and it's about moving into alternatives. And the political issues, the market concentration issues, the geography, what it does is it limits these alternatives, which is what is keeping demand for fossil fuels relatively inelastic. An inelastic demand for fossil fuels is bad news when it comes to a transition, because it means that all of the policy instruments that are available to us and, you know, have been the meat of the Paris Agreement policies that are marginal policy, changing marginal prices, so a carbon tax, for instance, they have to work much harder when we've got inelastic demand, when those alternatives aren't available. And, you know, we've seen lots of illustrations of just how inelastic our demand for fossil fuels is, especially in the short term, especially, for instance, in recent months, since the start of the war in the Middle East. Blockades of the Strait of Hormuz, it's a negative supply shock to oil and gas. You know, that shock becomes a price crisis only when we've got inelastic demand, and it's hard to switch out of those alternatives. And, you know, comparing what's happened to energy prices in, say, the UK and France is a really good illustration of this, because, you know, the France's nuclear power means they have a more elastic demand, so they are able to switch out of fossil fuels more easily. And the same supply shock has been less of a price crisis in these settings. So achieving the green transition, you know, we want policy tools. We have to really get a good understanding of what our demand for the technologies producing climate externalities look like. One very interesting research paper that has given us some real insight on this in one particular energy market is a paper by Professor Constanza Albuin, who's a professor at Johns Hopkins University. And she studied global markets for liquefied natural gas, which, as you all know, is a fossil fuel. But it's a fossil fuel that is not as damaging in terms of CO2 emissions, at least, as, say, coal-burning electricity generation. It's better than coal-burning electricity generation. It's not as good as renewables, such as solar, wind, and hydropower. But that her paper looks at what happens when there is a supply shock, an example of types of supply shock that we've seen, of the US limiting LNG exports. And what she shows is how versatile demand is, where it goes when there's when supply of LNG is reduced. In some countries, it goes to nuclear, it goes to solar power. In other countries, it goes to coal. And the net impact on carbon emissions depends on the interplay of all of these forces, and really focusing attention on what is shaping the nature of demand is really critical for developing our policy tools and thinking about where are the levers, where are the things that are most effective in terms of allowing firms, the users of carbon intensive fuels and households to find alternatives, to keep using alternatives, and to generally progress us along to the goals of the Paris Agreement.
Thanks very much, Catherine. Linda.
Thank you, Anna.
Right. So the good thing about being the final speaker is that lots of the main points have been made. So I'm just going to share a few thoughts on the geoeconomic context. And I think specifically on where I think it'd be good to have a thought discussion around the specific ways in which the green transition may be impacted kind of in the sort of near term. And this may not work, but there might actually be a way forward and just preventing you from, completely collapsing in the dismal science before then. So I'm going to finish with some thoughts about how I think even within this context, we can actually, I think, make progress on this essential goal for saving the planet. So the very first thing is, you know, it's a bad sign when economists have to talk about geopolitics. That's literally what geoeconomics is. IR colleagues here, international relations colleagues here, will define this era as the era of strategic competition, great power competition. So I have a definition, which is a little bit of a joke, but I think I can make it. So I do realize this is being recorded, but it's okay. So, right? All right, stay with me. So this is really an era of US-China competition. I think that is the predominant model. We can debate whether there's other competitive forces as well. So I am an ABC. So I am an American, British, Chinese. So I think I can make this joke. So if you ask Americans in their heart of hearts, they just want to be the G1. If you ask the Chinese, they'll say, do business with us. It's a win-win. But that normally means that China wins twice. Since Brexit, I'm not sure I can make this joke, but I will anyways. In Brussels, you hear this term, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. So this is capturing the pattern. We have gone in the green transition world from cooperation. That's exactly what the net zero targets, the Paris agreements, the various conference of the parties were intended to do. And we have gone from cooperation to competition. You see that in industrial policy. So for instance, the US Inflation Reduction Act, not really about inflation or reduction, maybe in the long term, much more about, renewables, support, all the things you do need, but it's very competitive. We've also moved from perhaps hyper-globalization, so that's a term that Daniel Roderick uses to describe the 1990s, into a more fragmented world as a result of that. And then importantly for the green transition, I think we do need to realize we're not in a first-best world, which is that multilateral system. We are in a second-best world, if even that, which means things like green regulations. So Europe, for instance, has tons of these, CSRD, you've got the green taxonomy, you've got Task Force on Nature-Related Financial Disclosures, which is the latest version of the Task Force on Financial-Related Financial Disclosures. So the fragmentation of the global regime in and of itself is an issue, because if you ask the World Trade Organization, they'll say, and the director has said, that what we actually need is a carbon price. So a global carbon price, but instead we have some countries with a different price. Some countries focus on the quantity of carbon, not the price of carbon, which is the emission trading scheme. Some countries do both. And if you map most of the world, a lot of them, not really sure what they're doing. So I did promise you there is a bit of a way forward on the back of this. So the LSE commission that I chaired, we brought together academics from across different departments, and we brought together practitioners. And essentially the framework, and I think this was just something I think worth mentioning, is that in this world where you have all the various factors you've already heard the panel talk about, is it possible to think about global public goods within a framework of the three C's? I didn't come up with this, by the way. Something very clever came up with a third C. So there are areas in which countries would cooperate, which is global public goods. They would compete, and that is about I don't know who controls space. No, that is about economic resilience, energy security, all the kinds of things you're hearing about. And then there is an area they call it's been called challenge, but that's really around your values, which you don't budge from. So as some countries begin to retreat from the green transition, it's incumbent on all of us that that's a value we're not going to cede.
So in that framework, global public goods is an area where I think it'd be good to have some reflection discussion on, because within this world, the world as it is, which is what President Obama likes to say, where are the ways in which we can really cooperate short of a global carbon price, despite the geopolitics? Can we talk about, for instance, financing for adaptation finance? So in other words, one of the key issues with the green transition is around the financing for developing countries. Adaptation finance is somewhat different, which is instead of having a bridge which is built in the old way, you would have a bridge which is resistant to, for instance, extreme weather. So there's I think, possibilities for that. There's also the ability, I think, to think harder about the ways in which regulatory systems and green bonds and even debt for equity swaps for some of these countries can just help mobilize green finance to help the green transition, because technologies need money. And I think to me, I'm going to stop there because I promised to end on a kind of slightly positive note. And I hope you think I'm not really an economist, because I'm not really much of a dismal scientist. I just think we have to find a way forward. So thank you.
Thank you so much. So I think I have just enough time for a quick fire round. And I think it builds on that positive ending. So I also like to be optimistic, but also realistic. So I guess my question for each of you for a kind of quick answer is, in your views, given this current context, the challenges that we've just been discussing, where are some of the biggest opportunities for countries like the UK to accelerate towards net zero and build resilience? Because obviously, for some, you know, there are economic forces that would say, well, the price of fossil fuels goes up, that does induce more demand in other areas, more efforts to invest in other things. So where are some of those opportunities? But what are the biggest barriers to them being realized? So I suppose in a kind of UK or European context, these countries that are seeking to be part of these value chains. Would you like to start, Peter?
Well, I think for Europe, I mean, the price of electricity is high on the list. If you want to maintain, I mean, it's not a problem in all sectors. In road transport, I don't think is a big issue. But if you break down some of the other sectors, particularly industry, it is probably the issue, and households are feeling that. And there are the plain answer is there is no easy answer to getting down the price of electricity in most European countries. I mean, different in Spain to Germany to the UK, but broadly speaking, Europe is a energy import dependent country, a continent, which is therefore going to have structurally higher energy prices than many other places. I do think it's just a massive public policy challenge. The answer in the medium term is very clearly to privilege domestic renewable resources. And around the margin, you might have a bit of nuclear or a bit of hydro, a bit of something else, but the core of your transition, your 80-90%, will be domestically produced energy based on renewables. The problem is you've got a 10 to 15 year big spike in capital expenditure in order to reap the benefits on operational savings of the daily import and burning of fossil fuels. That is just the fundamental public policy conundrum we're all dealing with, which is you're going to have to borrow more and invest more in order to reap the benefits in 10 or 15 years' time. And you're doing that in a context where the public is pretty cross, feels assailed by inflation and bad policy and so on and so forth. So that's if you're a policymaker, that's the conundrum you're trying to work. You generally know, I think. I don't think it's a mystery to most policymakers where they need to go. Getting there is enormously challenging. So I think getting energy prices, electricity prices down within reason, and I think, you know, there's lots of ideas there, but I think taking a bit more on the balance sheet rather than funding it through bills is probably part of the answer. So decoupling where you can the gas price from the electricity price. You have to invest in infrastructure, but making sure you're not over-investing in infrastructure. Because I think electrification, I think, will be one of the themes of the next few years. Electrification, not just on the producing the power, but how you run your economy, has got to be the answer. But if you ask people to electrify with high electricity costs, don't be surprised if they react. And I think that's what you're seeing from publics and industry across Europe. I think this is manageable. I think politically it's manageable. And I think Europeans, including the UK, are not managing the politics of it too badly. They're reversing tactically where they need to. But it's going to be a difficult 5 to 10 years, no doubt about it. This is just a very difficult public policy challenge. You're asking for big investments for saving down the line at a time when people are feeling very stretched.
Thank you. Can I actually go to Ed next? Because I just read your chapter about copper and the need. I mean, electrification in and of itself requires materials. And I don't know if you've got thoughts more generally, but if you also have some in terms of what are the challenges physically in terms of doing all of this?
Yeah, I mean, well, we're not, the planet is richer in minerals and the physical stuff we need than I think most people intuitively feel. I think we're almost hardwired to think of the finite nature of the planet. But actually, there is far more copper than we're ever going to need somewhere in the Earth's surface. The challenge is getting it out of the ground, refining it in a way that we can afford, and doing it in a way that doesn't cause long-term damage to the environment. When I kind of listened to your question, though, Anna, I kind of found myself thinking of the lithium-ion battery. And the fact that, you know, when you think back to the kind of early era of the motor car, there were these three competing technologies for what was going to be the, you know, the force that was going to drive all of our cars. There was petrol, obviously, we all know about that one. There were steam engines. So if you can imagine, and actually for a period, steam engines were the most powerful cars out there, or locomotives. So literally, we were living in a steampunk world 100 years ago, where people literally had these steam engines going around. But the third option at the time, I'm talking about kind of 1905 or so, was electric cars. And for a time, electric cars were the most popular option. But the reason the combustion engine succeeded, the internal combustion engines succeeded, was in large part because we just, at that point, hadn't cracked how to make a good enough battery. And, you know, the physics of electric cars is amazing, and it's quite inspiring. You don't have to be kind of a big proponent of net zero to think that electric cars are an extraordinary technology which will and is changing the world. The amount of energy that you put into a petrol car that is just wasted in the form of heat is about 80%. So 80% of the energy you put into your petrol car gets puffed away through the exhaust pipe. When you put power into an electric car, only 20% of it is wasted. So 80% of it is turned into motion. So you, as I say, the physics are pretty clear on this. Electric cars are amazing. But back to that lithium-ion battery, why was it that it took us 100 years to work out, you know, to get to that almost kind of platonic ideal of a car that takes power or energy and turns it into motion? It's because it is really, really hard to take something like lithium, you know, material that comes out of the ground, is very combustible, as anyone knows from their kind of, you know, science experiments at school, to turn that into something that can be a stable form of battery. But over literally decades, where this was a known challenge in engineering, over decades in chemistry, over decades, scientists worked out how to do it. And gradually by the kind of 80s and the 90s, we developed lithium-ion batteries. And I say we, because where did a lot of that happen? A lot of that happened in the UK. Dare I say, at a different university. You go to the chemistry labs in Oxford and you see a blue plaque that says this is where the first lithium-ion battery was invented. And actually, some of the earliest lithium-ion batteries, commercial lithium-ion batteries, were also developed in the UK. The difference and the challenge for the UK, and it goes alongside so many different technologies that famous we've invented but not actually kind of turned into commercial reality, is that often our brain power creates amazing, you know, has these amazing advances, amazing patents, which in turn then get exploited by other countries around the world. So there is an industrial challenge that we face. But the reason I'm kind of optimistic, and I swing, and I think we should all swing dramatically between optimism and desperate pessimism, because that's the world we live in right now. You know, extraordinary things are happening with technology, from you know, obviously from kind of green transition to things like AI. But by the same token, the degree of kind of geopolitical challenge and threat is slightly terrifying. But I you know, I would cling on to in the UK the fact that we have this extraordinary track record for science and for discovery and for inventiveness, which hopefully, notwithstanding the enormous kind of, you know, energy challenges we face, and we are on a continent that is pretty resource poor compared with the United States, which is just so lucky. But we're resource poor, as is China for that matter. But now that we're kind of thinking more about energy and thinking about where stuff comes from and thinking those kinds of things that maybe kind of were kind of lower down on the roster for a long time, whereas in China was thinking more strategically, perhaps we're at a better juncture where some of that brain power and some of that kind of industrial strategy, you know, that's nascent once again, can come together. So that's my kind of optimistic take. And on copper, I mean, we're not going to run out of copper, and we don't need to go to Mars to mine things, by the way. And we don't need to go to asteroids to mine things. We have amazing abilities, you know, largely through our ingenuity, of getting the materials we need out of the ground and turning them into the tools that will improve our living standards. And part of that is the story of the energy transition.
Thank you. And I think, you know, that view of innovation being a source of optimism is one that we kind of share in the work we do at the LSE. But also last week was a pretty eventful week with Invest in UK University R&D, a big conference, and London Tech Week kind of showcasing these strengths. Lyndon, do you have some thoughts on this question?
So I think it's good not to be an economic superpower right now. Bear with me. So the UK is not the US or China, to state the obvious. So while they are, as I would just give you an example, there's a story of how the WTO head became the former Nigerian finance minister. She got it because basically US proposed a candidate, China said no, China proposed a candidate, the US was like, no, thank you. So basically, I think it's a really strategic moment for the UK to position itself as a leader in the green transition. And what do we have to offer? Actually, we have a lot of financial expertise to offer. Regardless of where the economy is as a whole, London remains one of the leading international financial centers. And that, I think, gives us an opportunity to both do the right thing and also transition finance, if done correctly, actually does. It works for the lenders. It actually works for in a way that I think it's just worth mentioning. So in other words, we could be the leaders in green transition. We could be the leaders in adaptation finance. We could be the leaders in green bonds. We could be the leaders in advisory services. We have great law firms. We have great financial advisors. In fact, the UK has such a good capital market. This is actually one of the conundrums or the dilemmas or the paradoxes as to why we don't have more unicorns, given that we have so much money here in the capital. It's actually called the Wimbledon effect, by the way. Don't kill me, but I'm not sure this is entirely true, so don't get upset. But basically, we host world-class sporting events, but we don't have world-class sports people, which, by the way, I love Andy Murray, so this is not a comment on tennis. So what I mean is we have this moment to position ourselves while others are in retreat or in competition. And I actually think that is something we should be seizing. And what are the obstacles to it? Anna, I should ask you, because in your previous role, you're probably better able to answer that than any of us here.
That was a great answer on the finance. And just to plug a report we recently, with colleagues at CTEX here at LSE, we published a report on adaptation where we highlighted all those strengths in financial services, professional and business services too. Catherine, final word before we open up to the audience on this?
Final word, perhaps tying a few of my colleagues' comments together, is that, you know, these new technologies have certain characteristics, perhaps share characteristics of the economics being slightly different. So the new technologies exist, but why are there frictions in the markets? Why do we not have the ability to make large-scale capital investments, that it will become sunk costs, that are fixed costs in exchange for, you know, low marginal cost technologies that are not climate change inducing. And there is the mass mismatch between political time horizons and investment time horizons. And of course, you know, it's actually a paradox that any immediate price crises, such as we've seen in the last few months, is actually is shortening the gap between those two horizons. It makes it more urgent to find those alternative solutions, finds the way to fix those markets for alternative new technologies to make it easier for firms and consumers to switch into them. And incentives are increasingly aligned as we face more difficulties in non-green markets.
Thank you. Right. I think we'll be moving on to audience Q&A.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Please do raise your hand. I'll select some questions in a group and then put them to the panel to respond to whatever they feel they can respond to. Please let us know your name and affiliation as you ask a question and try to keep it quite short and a question if possible. So there's a couple here, one over there in the front as well. Shall we go to one here, this lady and this lady? For the first round. Yeah.
Hello. Thank you for the interesting comments. And my name is Alex. I'm a student here at the LSE. My question for the panel is, traditionally there has been this focus on renewable energy as the force behind the green transition. So we think about solar panels, we think about wind farms, when we think about the green transition. But are there other sectors which could possibly propel the green transition? So we're thinking as green cement, green steel. Are there any sectors which have low-hanging fruits, so to speak, if you can invest in more than just simply building more solar panels and more?
Brilliant. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Emily. I work for an energy network company. I wanted to pick up on the points made about energy prices. In the UK, our prices are about four times higher than the US, about three times higher than the average in Europe. And as a consequence, we are in part deindustrializing because of high energy prices and then becoming reliant on imports that are, in some cases, made in more carbon-intensive countries. In the domestic sector, the high prices are very unpopular. Price spikes. People are choosing whether to heat their homes or to eat. And the debt in the energy market, in the retail market, is around $4.5 billion. And we have two political parties in this country who say that they would repeal the Climate Change Act, in part because they're leveraging off the challenges around high energy prices. So it's a provocative question, but is there an argument for going a little slower in the UK in order to get the energy prices down and then accelerate later in order to hold the political consensus together in the short term?
Thanks, Emily. And over here. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Ray Wang, LSE graduate. My question is that just now I heard about three keywords from Linda: competition, cooperation, and challenge. And I also heard another word that is frequently mentioned, that is alternative. So I have a specific example. Just now I searched on Google and I saw the example that is talking about something about the electricity. So in the UK, surplus solar electricity is exchanged with the national grid while the government backed the smart export guarantee scheme. So under this scheme, people can get some benefit from their surplus electricity made from the solar panels installed in their household. So it's good thing because the price are to some extent reduced. And my specific example is here in this specific scenario, we have the solar panels to install in a household, and the solar panels are produced or imported from companies of whose parent company are Chinese companies. So in this case, can I say it's kind of cooperation, though it is not at the national level, it is a manifestation of cooperation. And in this case, should we still think of alternatives just because in this case, oh, the solar panels are imported from Chinese companies? Yeah, that's my question for Peter. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So that's specifically for Peter. Do you want to start with that and then take any other and then we'll just go down?
Yeah, I'll be very brief. So there's no horizontal answer. You have to get to the specific sector, which is the difficulty of all this, is that you actually have to do some work. So there is no point in Europe trying to compete with China in the production of solar panels. That market is gone. European production is negligible and there's no point trying to resurrect it. If you're worried about security, you do what the Europeans are doing, which is you say you have to, for public funding, you have to get the inverters, which are the sort of intelligent bit of the solar panel and in Europe, and then you can worry about the technology layers on that, which are the brain function. But for dumb kit like solar panels, no, you should import Chinese. And if you're worried about this in time, then you'll have alternatives in Southeast Asia and in India. But it's different in other sectors. So permanent magnets, rare earths, European governments, I think, are legitimately concerned about the extraordinary level of their dependence on China. And we've seen that used by China even in recent months in order to gain leverage in negotiations primarily with the United States. And in the middle, you have something like batteries, where there's a genuine dilemma, I think, for Europeans about whether they think having a European battery industry is a strategic issue or not. Is a battery a dumb bit of kit? Or is it the core to an EV industry? Is it the core of your military industrial complex? Is it the key to storage? I mean, there is no renewable based energy system in the UK which isn't very heavily dependent on batteries. So I think batteries are at the heart of the what do we think is strategic and what do we think is dumb kit that we should import. And I can wax lyrical about how if you think it's strategic, you might do something about it. But I think my main point is you have to be specific and sectoral, and not only sectoral, you have to look at the bits of the components you're worried about. And trying to replicate everything China does is not a good use of public resource. And I don't think most countries' balance sheets will stand it. So you've got to be targeted. Just on the renewables, again, so number one, what do you do if you're a country trying to decarbonize? First thing, you deal with the power system. So the generation of electricity, you decarbonize that. Tends to be the next biggest source is road transport. So you go after road transport and so on. And buildings is probably third or second. And so you move through the sectors and you have to do all of them. The ones you named are cement and steel. And some of those are easier to do once you've decarbonized. So steel, the future of steel production in most advanced economies will be electric, and you'll probably not produce iron in most of Europe. You'll probably import the iron and produce the steel in an electric arc furnace. You do that when you've got clean electricity, when you've decarbonized your system, and you then rely on other countries to produce the iron pellets, which are high energy and low value. So it depends on the sector and you have to do them all, but there is a sort of order to doing them. And some of them where we're going slow at the moment. So I would say we're behind the curve on industrial decarbonization, and we're where you would have expected and hoped to be on the electricity system. It's because some of them are just harder. Cement and steel in industrial sectors are just a bit harder. And that's before you even talk about agriculture and land use. I mean, we're not even touched the sides there. That will be an issue really for the 2030s. There's only so much, with the best will in the world, there's only so much you can do with the resources, both political and real, that are available to you at any one time. I'll stop there.
Thank you, Linda.
I just want to pick up on that a little bit. I know we're probably lots of other people want to ask questions. I think technology is always mooted to be part of the solution. So green hydrogen, for instance, that is something that, I think there is an initiative Bill Gates has been working on. So, but I think on a more sort of, you asked if there are any kind of low-hanging fruit, and the answer there is, well, actually, yes, there's 12 high-emitting sectors, which would cover off oil and gas, it would cover off coal, it would cover off, a number of sectors. Those could be actively managed using the technologies today, so long as producers and consumers hold to account those companies which are emitting and the financiers who are measuring their scope 3 emissions by how much they are lending to those companies, both in terms of what's called finance emissions and facilitated emissions. So to get to 2030, for a lot of the sectors, even measurement, you mentioned agriculture, yes, that is an issue, and Satellite, for instance, is now better able to try and measure some of increase the measurement of things, including the production of methane, which is much worse for the environment than CO2. So what I'm suggesting is if we all went back and looked at, you know, annual reports, the net zero pathway, scope one, scope two, which is more in the control of most companies, scope three emissions, which is about suppliers, distributors, I think you'll get a sense that even with what we have today, we could do more. And to me, that's actually the low-hanging fruit. Of course, I do hope Bill Gates succeeds and we have green hydrogen. I mean, why not?
Thank you. Catherine?
I just wanted to comment that there is probably no one right answer here. And resilience to the very different types of geopolitical and economic challenges that, for example, exist in different sources of electricity generation, It will involve a bundle of different technologies and the ability to switch between different sources. And I think that's what we see other countries have been able to do more easily in response to oil and gas price shocks recently. It's about maintaining the infrastructure and the resilience across different types of technologies. As to the crisis, there are no short-term answers related to new investment horizons are medium to long term. At the moment, we have a different political crisis, which is a distributional crisis, and making sure we separate out these objectives and possibilities is really, I think, one route to engineering our way out of the carbon emissions that are medium to long term priority.
Thank you. Ed?
Well, I'll be really quick. I completely agree. I think one of the biggest challenges with net zero is it's not just about power. I mean, as Peter's alluding to, the hardest nuts to crack are, for the most part, the industrial side of it. And we're still such a long way from there, but there is such potential there. And for most people, do not realize that there is vastly more carbon emissions coming from cement production or steel production. Either of them are multiples of plane, aviation emissions. So the more focus we could have on that, the better. I mean, if you look at the number of patents that have been taken out right now, so cement, Portland cement, which is at the heart of this, that was obviously a British Industrial Revolution invention to the extent that we kind of work out the history of it. The majority of patents, as far as we can see, on green cement are happening in China. And so that's an interesting kind of litmus test for where things are heading. The question about kind of energy and net zero, I think we didn't have a proper conversation back in 2019. Is it 2019? Sorry to look at you, Peter, about this.
Net zero, 2019.
I mean, how many weeks of debate did net zero have in the House of Commons when the Climate Change Act was signed into motion? Does anyone know the answer to this? The answer is, I think, 80 minutes for one of the most consequential pieces of legislation that this country may ever have. And just a conversation, it wasn't necessarily had then. And so the fact that people are now feeling kind of irked by the fact that, you know, all sorts of consequences, many of which are not down to renewables, some of which are down to geopolitics, but their energy bills are higher. It's a complicated question as to how much of that is down to green levies. But nonetheless, we needed to have that conversation a few years ago, and it's a shame that we didn't. And just finally, if the advances that we've seen in China in terms of the learning curves coming down, the cost of solar, some of the advances in battery production, LFP batteries, this amazing technology, which had been kind of discarded by most people for a long time. Now China has made that extraordinarily kind of powerful in all senses of the word. The difficulty we're faced with right now is that, you know, we could solve so many of the crises we're talking about right now if we could just totally absolve ourselves from all of the geopolitics and the stuff we're talking about right now. The problem is that that's kind of intruding into this conversation. It would be nice if we could just buy stuff, everything cheaply from China, and we would see our emissions go down. A lot of problems would be solved. But that's the irrational world that we're living in right now, this irrational moment of one superpower thrusting up against another superpower and everyone getting a bit kind of het up about it. And it's hard to see a way around that.
So I think we've got time for some online questions, which Helen over here can relay. And then depending on how many, hopefully one or two from the room. Okay.
So Shivi, who is an LSE alumni, says, thank you for the very lovely discussion. My question is, what role do you see of the UK and other Western countries in helping countries of the South to be part of this green transition?
Thank you. And maybe a couple from further back this time. That gentleman over there. And over there, at the towards the back. Sorry. Okay, if we do quick answers, let's have one more. You seem very persistent there. So this gentleman over here, but sorry.
Mark Cliff from University of Exeter. I want the panel to look ahead 2.5 years to a post-Trump world and paint two scenarios. One, the most plausible upside scenario, and two, the most plausible downside scenario.
Thank you. Where was we had one back there?
Yeah, thank you. My name is Sofia Bustamante. I'm a student here. And I wonder how we incorporate justice in the green transition. I think that is really important, especially talking about the global south and global north and how, you know, those materials that can make so many innovations are generally taken down from other territories. So I wondered about justice in this transition.
Thank you. And just that.
Thanks, first of all, for allowing me. Good evening, everyone. It was a pleasure to listen to you all. I am Ashish from India and a regular visitor to LSE. My question is, post-pandemic, there has been this trend that every country is, you know, looking to create inwards. Now, in that scenario, I want to understand how the middle economies will navigate through this green transition when there is won't they be get crushed by the subsidies which are being let down by UK, US or European Union as such? Thank you.
Great, thank you. So let's start with Ed this time. And we've got UK and Global South, or UK and other countries supporting Global South. We've got Trump, post-Trump scenarios. We've got justice. And we've got how do middle economies create inwards. Yeah.
Lots of big ones to finish with. When I'm thinking about the kind of that question of the development impact of net zero, and I think about, I know this sounds crazy, but I think about the amount of steel that we have in our lives. So if you think about a country like the UK, the amount of steel, literally I'm talking about physical steel, iron. Per capita is about kind of between 10 and 15 tons per capita. So everyone here in the audience, you know, if they're from the UK or Europe, or indeed America, on average, you have about 15 tons of steel in your life. You may not kind of be particularly aware of that steel at any given time, but you've got it there. It's in the car that you may drive. It's in the public transport system you take. It's in the building right around us here. It's in the hospitals, the schools, all of these different things. Steel is a pretty good metric for the degree of development and living standards we have in different countries around the world. I kind of prefer it to GDP per capita. It's about 15 tons in this country. In China, it's about 8 tons per capita. In India, it's, I think, around 1 ton per capita. In parts of sub-Saharan Africa, it's under 0.1 tons per capita. And what does that mean? It means people don't have cars. It means they don't have hospitals. It means they don't have schools. They don't have public transport systems. And they want all of those things. And of course they want those things, because part of having development is having the infrastructure around you that allows you to lengthen your life and to have better living standards. And one of the great challenges we're faced with, I mean, this is why it comes back to, you know, net zero and the energy transition. One of the great challenges we're faced with right now is there is no cheap way of making virgin steel that doesn't involve extraordinary carbon emissions. Look at a blast furnace. The biggest product of a blast furnace is carbon by weight. steel, the iron, pig iron that comes out is a byproduct. Carbon, these things are enormous carbon production machines. And yet there is no other way of taking iron out of the ground and turning it into steel that we have, which is what we need to do, by the way, in order to get the amount of steel per capita in places like sub-Saharan Africa up towards maybe not 15, but maybe 8 or maybe 9 or maybe 10. And over the course of the next few years, we need, if people are going to have better living standards, for them to have more steel. And to do that in a way that's not going to involve enormous amounts of carbon emissions will be very, very costly. And who is going to bear that cost? And I think that's a conversation, by the way, that's a rhetorical question, because I don't think there is a particularly compelling answer. And COP is kind of edging towards having that conversation, but it's still a long way off it. So I think, you know, that question is absolutely at the heart of this, which is that for many countries around the world who look at their living standards and want to improve them and want to have more steel, in other words, public transport systems, hospitals, schools, they see all of these net zero plans and they look at them and think, isn't this just a way to stifle our progress? And that's an uncomfortable conversation, but it's a conversation I don't think we've had enough of here in the developed world, which many people, you know, in emerging developing economies feel and are concerned about. So, that's absolutely the heart of it. I'll rather than doing all of the questions, I've blathered on too long. So that's my feeling.
Thank you. Catherine?
To pick up on something that Linda said earlier, some international global markets are quite well functioning. Capital markets can be well functioning. Foreign direct investment can be politically neutral. Where there is value to be created, where there are opportunities for development, if we protect the well-functioning properties of those markets, then these can be completely separate questions for thinking about the rate of economic development in the global south and in middle income economies. And keeping a clear view on what is working well, what's producing these negative externalities, where is the economics and geopolitics causing market failure and causing distortions. Keeping these things separate, I think, is really important for clarity in terms of thinking about overall progress.
Thank you. Linda and Peter, one of you, I think, should do the post-Trump scenarios question, which is very tricky. But Linda, what would you like to respond to?
I'm happy to take at that.
Oh, yeah, no, you do that. Okay.
I'll just focus. I think I know we're out of time, but I want to thank all of you for raising the question of the just transition, because we haven't covered it. And that really is at the heart of how we're going to get to save our planet by whatever time frame. Some of these countries have different time frames. But the just transition, just briefly, has a lot of components. So what is the pace of the green transition, which is appropriate for that country, supporting their living standards? What are the financial and advisory help that can be given by countries who are further along? Some of these countries are also the source of a lot of these critical minerals. But as we know, part of the issue is the environmental cost of the extraction. And one of the reasons why China dominates processing is because it's willing to take the environmental cost. So there are complicated dynamics at play, which I think we're all fairly aware of. But the question is, can we move towards a future which is around, can we cooperate in a way around this global public good that can, make those deals, make those, frameworks that can move us forward. So basically what was envisioned, I think, before the world started to increasingly fragment. So the world is what it is now. There's a lot more focus on resilience, but resilience is not exclusive in the framework that I've described to cooperating where you need to, or we won't get there. So for me, I'm glad we started talking about the just transition. I'm sure this will be the first of many conversations around it. So thank you.
Thank you. And we are 4 minutes over time. So can you answer that question?
On the justice question, I think there'll be a lot of leapfrogging by the emerging and developing economies in the transition. If you look at what's going on at the moment, they are going faster than I thought they would. They don't have the legacy systems or politics. So I think, and then most 75% of the world's population lives in energy import dependent countries. And if you look at what's actually going on, solar panel imports, battery imports, now 2- and 3-wheeler imports, I think there will be leapfrogging. And I think in broad terms, that is a positive justice story. I had a go a couple of years ago at trying to persuade governments that geopolitics and justice can be reconciled, because if you think you're in a global competition for the good opinion of the world, which you are if you're a middle power like the UK with China, then you need to be persuasive and you need to have a good offer to developing countries, and that climate change is now at the centre of that. So you need a good offer on mitigation, a good offer on adaptation. And I think that's a sound intellectual argument. It's got absolutely no traction in terms of public policy. I think it's fair to say his aid budgets have been slashed comprehensively. Since just on the US, I won't do good and bad. What do I think? I think the energy policy of the United States, which is a domestic energy policy, which it's seeking to export, I think is not proving successful. The world is not persuaded of the United States' offer on energy policy, and it's had remarkably little impact on the energy policy choices of other countries, including those like the UK, who are very exposed to US influence. UK has its own issues, but none of them have been affected by US energy policy. So I think the net result of Donald Trump on the pace of the global transition will be won't be noticed, apart from the war in Iran, which I think will be a material accelerant of the transition.
Thank you very much. Sorry to have overrun. Thank you so much to all our speakers and to the audience for this fascinating discussion. There are many more events in the LSE Festival programme. I didn't want to deflect your question back to me. I'll be speaking in an event tomorrow around lunchtime on green industrial policies and UK challenges and opportunities. So thank you very much. Please join me in thanking.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.